Welcome to Two-Way Street. We're going to begin today's show with a conversation with the great Georgia blues guitarist Tinsley Ellis. Creative Loafing just named him Blues Artist of the Year. He's been around for a long time now. Tinsley began playing in bands while he was a student at Emory University in the mid-70s, and he released his first solo album back in 1988. Rolling Stone wrote about his guitar playing that his eloquence dazzles and that he achieves pyrotechnics that rival the early Jeff Beck and Eric Clapton. Tinsley Ellis has just released a new record called Red Clay Soul. Tinsley Ellis, what are we listening to?
That sounds like one off the new CD, and that one says, I ain't much, but I'm all I ever think about.
The first song on your new record, Red Clay Soul, it's, as you say, all I think about. Welcome to Two-Way Street.
It's great to be here, Bill.
I saw it, I was looking at Blues Blast magazine, and in reviewing your new record, Red Clay Soul, they said there's rejoicing in the land every time Tinsley Ellis puts out a new album, and the release of the soulful Red Clay Soul is no exception.
High praise. Rejoicing in the land. That sounds biblical.
You named this record Red Clay Soul because essentially it evokes your adopted state, Georgia, right?
That's right. Well, you know, I was born here in Atlanta. 1957, and, you know, being a Georgia artist, that's my birthright, and it feels real comfortable to me, and other parts of the country, if you talk about the red clay and the red clay soil and the embankments carved out for roads on the people's trips down to Florida or something, they know exactly what you're talking about when they see that red clay. They know they're in Georgia.
You said at one point, whether it's in an interview or something you wrote, Georgia's where the blues got soul. What do you mean by that?
Well, if I think about Chicago blues with the harmonica and slide guitar, that's their sound. If I think about Texas blues with T-Bone Walker or Stevie Ray Vaughan, they definitely have their sound too, and some swinging horn bands down there. But if I think about Georgia, I think about Ray Charles in particular, or Little Richard. And it's kind of a churchy kind of sound that they have. And I think that's our heritage, you know, is where they mix the gospel in with the blues. And no one did it better than Ray Charles, in my opinion.
You have a tremendous reputation as being just a powerful blues guitar player. And you've had that reputation for a long, long time. Where did you first learn to play the guitar?
Well, I'm pinning it all on the Beatles. I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan's show in 1964. I'd be a liar if I told you that I didn't hear blues versions of Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters first, done by artists like the Yardbirds,
yeah,
and the Animals, and then later Cream. And it sort of became a pilgrimage to find the original versions of this music.
The evolution of the blues is really interesting. Mm-hmm. And I understand you yourself are not a blues historian in an academic sense. But I want to play for you a song that was recorded in 1920. Mamie Smith, who was discovered by W.C. Handy, who, the story goes, really was the first one to really hear the blues. He was in a train station in the Midwest somewhere.
That's right.
Right? You know this story?
On the Mississippi River somewhere.
Okay.
Maybe St. Louis.
That may be right.
Like,
and he kind of fell asleep waiting for a train, and he woke up, and there was somebody sitting across from him, right? Some sort of ragged kind of character.
That's right.
With a guitar, right?
That's right. And I've got my guitar here, and this is similar to what he probably heard, something kind of, you know.
Thank you.
and he didn't know what to call it. But what he was hearing was Delta Blues for the first time. And it's when Delta Blues went up the river, making it to Chicago and places like that, that it became something else. And it became Chicago Blues, and then it became rock and roll.
Yeah, and the story is that he heard that way back in 1903. In 1920, Mamie Smith sold several million copies of this record called Crazy Blues. What do you think about when you hear that song?
Well, that sounds to me like Delta Blues, but played in almost like a big band or Dixieland format.
Yeah. When you hear Mamie Smith sing Crazy Blues, though, do you hear the roots of what you do today, or does it sound very completely different?
No, I really do, because it's got that sound that that we associate with Robert Johnson, and Robert Johnson was basically the standard bearer for a lot of people that were playing like that at the time. There was Son House, and who was rediscovered in the folk circuit in the early 60s. Yeah. And in Georgia, we had Blind Willie McTell. And it's that same kind of sound, but when she just did what she did, they put it in a big band or a ragtime Dixieland format. And so really it just proves that, you know, that blues, Delta Blues is the starting point, and it's a matter of how far you want to take it. Do you want to take it as far as Keb Moe and keep it kind of traditional, or do you want to take it as far as, say, ZZ Top or the Allman Brothers?
What do you like to do with it?
Well, you know, I've got to do my own thing. Blues is my love, but rock and roll is my heritage, so I lean more towards the Allman Brothers approach.
Yeah, you're kind of considered a smoking blues guitar player.
Yeah, I get kind of worked up there, and I turn it up. But when I was a teenager, I was the annoying kid that would follow the old blues guys around and ask them questions. Because at this point, it all started when a friend of mine down in South Florida where I grew up, he said, I hear you getting into this Mike Bloomfield and Peter Green and Eric Clapton. He goes, but there's a guy you got to go see. And I said, who is that? And he said, you've got to go see B.B. King. And I said, what is a B.B. King? And he said, well, you got to go see him. And he was doing a teen show. They shut down the bar, and Mr. King played for teenagers on a Saturday afternoon at the Marco Polo Hotel in North Miami Beach. Hour-long show, 30 or 40 of us there. And I saw the blues for the first time in B.B. King. Was shortly after, and he greeted us on the lobby and met us. And he was just so nice. It was almost like Santa Claus or something. The nicest man. So I got the feeling that all these blues guys, they must be like really friendly people. And the next guy I went to see was Howlin' Wolf. So Howlin' Wolf is standing off to the side of the stage, and he had just done an unbelievable set, which included Little Red Rooster. And he was standing over there, and I said, I'm going to go meet Mr. Wolf, because Mr. King was so friendly. And I walked towards Howlin' Wolf, and the closer I got, the bigger and the more angry he looked. So I went and took a hard left and went and got a Coca-Cola. So I never got to meet Howlin' Wolf, but I saw him play. And I never forget, he did the... Too lazy to crow for days. Been no peace in the barnyard since that little red rooster went away.
Wow.
Wow. You know, and he did that, and it was just amazing. And that sound stuck in my head, just like it stuck in W.C. Handy's head when he first heard it at that train station. It's all built on that in rock and roll for me. It starts with that, and it ends up with the White Stripes or something, Black Keys, something modern today.
You talk about the derivation of blues, how it morphed into the British invasion bands and was brought back here so you could listen to it. So let's, for a second, listen to an example of that. Talk about Robert Johnson. Who was Robert Johnson?
Robert Johnson was from Mississippi and pretty much an itinerant bluesman, never had an artist, just hooked up with people in the area that he played. And his songs were covered by people like Eric Clapton, Cream, Rolling Stones did Love in Vain, and his songs are still covered today.
All right, let's listen to Robert Johnson singing one of his best-known songs, Crossroads. As a teenager growing up in Skokie, Illinois, I had never heard Robert Johnson sing Crossroads, but I sure as heck heard it when Cream sang it. And you heard that growing up, too.
I sure did. I'd be a liar if I didn't tell you that the first time I heard Crossroads was by Cream.
Yeah,
that version
too.
You just played.
Right.
But then I dug back and I got Robert Johnson's albums on Columbia and listened back to it. And, you know, I just want to know all about this music I love so much. And which one is better? I'm not sure. But which one is blues? Well, I'm absolutely sure that the Robert Johnson version is blues. Well, then what did Eric Clapton do with Cream? Well, that could probably be best described as blues rock.
Blues rock, which is what you love to do.
Which is what it's my heritage. Blues is my love, and rock is my heritage.
You've had some interesting chapters in your life. I think one of the most interesting is when you played in a band at that great musicians' venue, Six Flags Over Georgia.
When I was a student at Emory University, I went and auditioned for Six Flags live show department. We did 9 shows a day, starting at 10:30 in the morning and right up to the fireworks display. Played 9 sets a day in the hot sun in full polyester. And even though I did not get a chance to do much blues out there, it gave me a really good start in show business. I learned how to do stuff like what happens when you break a guitar string on stage. I learned that you always have a backup guitar there. I learned how to react to an audience. It was a great experience that sometimes I make a little fun at because, you know, we're playing in front of the roller coaster and we're doing cover songs. But yeah, and as a college student, it was great. There were 5 of us in a 2-bedroom apartment out there, and we were like the monkeys. We had a good time. I'll just leave it at that.
You got fired? The band got fired?
We got fired for quitting, yes.
What does that mean?
It means we wanted to play at high school dances. We had an opportunity to do that in the fall, and then on our way out, they thought it was a good idea to fire. We were very fireable, I will add that.
Well, you were lucky you weren't fired when you insisted, despite management's telling you not to, I think. Am I right? You played Eric Clapton's Cocaine at one point against management wishes.
Where are you getting this information?
I'm right, aren't
I? I didn't know this would be an expose. Well, yeah, we did. They told us that not to play Eric Clapton's version of the J.J. Cale song Cocaine, and we played it anyway, and we denied playing it, and they called us in an office, and they had a cassette of it. Somebody went out and recorded us doing it, and pretty good version of it, I thought, but that was on the no-no list.
The story is that when you finally left, you literally had to give back your costumes, including your platform shoes.
Yes, we had to give back our costumes, and we'd wear our platform shoes home every night, so we all left the park barefoot, and the ultimate disgrace.
Let's take a break now. When we come back, more with Tinsley Ellis. You're listening to Two Way Street. Welcome back to Two Way Street. If you're just joining us, my guest is Tinsley Ellis. Creative Loafing has just named him Blues Artist of the Year. He has a new record out called Red Clay Soul. I think of just a couple of different kinds of music that are truly American, and they overlap, obviously. I mean, the blues and roots, what we call roots music, folk music, they're really, where's the difference? There's an invisible line separating those music. The Appalachian, the music of Appalachian, the Appalachian Mountains and the blues have many similarities, yes?
They really do. And people from far away recognize that a lot more than we do. When we go to Europe, things like bluegrass and blues, or even blues rock, is lumped into a category called jazz.
Yeah.
And jazz is what America has. That's our greatest export. And we don't have kings or queens here, but we have people like Louis Armstrong and B.B. King and Ray Charles. That's our royalty. And I think that is truly something that we take a lot of heat in other countries for all kinds of things that we do as a nation, but when they talk about jazz, when they talk about American music, all of a sudden we are beloved.
Well, you've toured all over the world.
Yes, I have.
When you say you're in Europe or in Asia, do you find that the audiences there are with you in a way that at times surprises you? Are they more attuned to what you're doing than some of the American audiences you play for?
It's amazing how familiar they are with what we do as roots artists in other countries. We went to faraway places. We played in the Canary Islands, which is off the coast of Africa, and people were talking about albums I did in the 80s with the Heartfixers. We played it at Moscow at the Performing Arts Center there. And they had the foresight to have every single CD I had ever made. They had a stack of them on a table for me to sign that they sold to the fans there. I signed hundreds of CDs. Now, unfortunately, all of the CDs they had were bootlegs. And I thought, well, this is great. How do they gather? I've never even seen a record store with this many of my CDs in it. And I looked at it, and the color was a little different on it, so you know, it's not like the Wild West over there. You know, they can just, if you want to get a Coca-Cola, you may get some kind of a local soft drink in a Coca-Cola can. And if you did that in America, they'd put you under the jail. The FBI would have a word with you. But over there in Moscow, sure enough, they had bootlegged every album. So I just sat there like a good sport and signed them all.
Can we talk about how you created this record, the new record, Red Clay Soul? What was in your head? What were you thinking about? And how did you select? I'm sure you write far more songs than you end up being able to put on any given record. How did that process take place in terms of this one?
Well, during my downtime, usually in the winter when I'm not on tour, I have a studio out in Tucker, Georgia, on Main Street there. And I go up there and kind of get a lot of music stuff done up there. And And I write songs, and I don't write one day I may write a rock song, one day I might write an acoustic song, one day I might write a song, and I write the song, and I finish the song, and then I move on to the next one. And then I put them on my laptop, and every once in a while I'll get together and sort of make a collection of certain songs that seem to go together. And then the new album leans more towards a collection of songs that I gathered, demos, and it sounded kind of soulful to me. And it sounded like Georgia music to me. So red clay soul means the sound of the music in Georgia.
With your permission, I would like to play a little bit of one of the songs on that record that just really spoke to me.
Okay.
Can I choose it?
Yes, choose.
Let's listen to a little bit of Colin.
I haven't heard from you all week. Right now I could feel a whole lot better. Now I'm living in uncertainty. Wondering how the situation came to be.
That's Tinsley Ellis, Colin, from his new record, Red Clay Soul. I chose that because I think it represents. I didn't know that you chose these songs because you felt they all had a certain kind of soulfulness to them. But I thought when I heard the record, that song really has it, Tinsley.
Thank you very much. I wrote that song with a writer up in Nashville named John Tiven. And that song has been recorded a few times by other artists. And this was the first time that I was able to do it. And, it's kind of got more of an Al Green kind of sound.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It does have an Al Green sort of sound to it. Thank you for putting that in my head. That's what it sounds like to me. Do you have a favorite song on the record?
Hearing myself sing is sort of like when you call your own answering machine to get your messages and you hear your voice, your announcement voice, you go, ooh, is that me? We'll multiply that by about 100, and that's what it sounds like. I like on this particular album, I like the Hungry Woman Blues song. That one kind of does it all for me.
I just can't seem to avoid it. Nothing but the Hungry Woman Blues. Agree, you just argue. Do just what you wanna do. Take my life if you could do it.
I want to go back if I can. You've mentioned B.B. King several times.
Yeah.
And that he was an inspiration.
Big inspiration.
For you. I want to listen to a little of a record that he made, and then I'd love to listen a little bit of the cover you did of that same record. Fair enough?
Okay.
Let's listen to B.B. King doing Standing on the Edge of Love.
Late last night, I was dreaming of your charm. I was standing on the edge of love, darling, with you in my arms. Well, you whispered sweet things.
You talk about soul, B.B. King. You like that song?
Oh, yeah, I like that.
All right, let's listen to you. You recorded it some years ago as well, so why don't we listen to your version?
Late last night I was dreaming. Dreaming of your charms. I was standing on the edge of love, darling. You in my arms.
Tinsley Ellis covering B.B. King, Standing on the Edge of Love. What do you think about when you try to cover a song by one of the artists who you admire most?
You know, that song was pitched to me by the writer Jerry Lynn Williams, and I recorded it having never heard the B.B. King version of it. And had really? I known that B.B. King did the song, I don't think I would have recorded it. But Tom Dowd, who produced that album on me over at Southern Tracks on Claremont Road, he brought that song with him. And that song was originally pitched to Eric Clapton, who did not do it. And I thought I was getting a fresh song that nobody had recorded. And then later on found that B.B. King had done it.
So you had not heard the B.B. King version?
All I heard was the demo that Jerry Williams
had
done.
Yours stands up pretty darn well, Tinsley.
It's different, but he definitely outsang me on it.
Here's what I'd love to do as we come to a close. You've got your guitar here. We've heard a little of it. Do you have a song you'd like to play us out with?
Yeah, I'll do one. Well, I was born down in Georgia, way out in the woods. Yes, I was born down in Georgia, way out in the woods. But I was raised up in Florida, where I learned all and everything I could. Well, I got me a guitar. People, you know, way back when I was only 9. Yes, I got me a guitar. People, you know, way back when I was only 9. And my daddy tried to tell me, son, you must be out of your mind. Wound up in Atlanta, where my luck went kind of slim. So I had to leave my woman and hit the highway once again. I was born down in Georgia, way out in the woods. But I was raised up in Florida, where the sun shines, it feels so good.
Story of Tinsley Ellis's life. New record, Red Clay Soul. Tinsley, as I told you when we first saw you, I've been a huge fan of yours for a very long time, and it's just a joy to have you come in and be part of Two Way Street. Thanks so much for being here, and best of luck with this newest record.
Thanks for having me.
We've posted a couple of videos of Tinsley Ellis playing blues guitar on our website at gpb.org/TWS and on our Facebook page. We also have more information on his new record, Red Clay Soul, posted as well. When we come back from a break, we're going to turn to a conversation about playwright Edward Albee, a towering figure in world theater who died last week at age 88. Welcome back to Two Way Street. My wife and I were in London last week to see theater when we heard the news that the great American playwright Edward Albee had died. We were actually on our way to see a play when we saw the headline. and my first thought was that it was his writing, among a small handful of other playwrights, that sparked my lifelong passion for theater. I was in high school when Albee's Who's Afraid Virginia Woolf premiered on Broadway. It caused an immediate sensation in the theater world, and it electrified me because it helped me understand that theater could be more than simple entertainment. It could challenge us to look at the world in a new way. Virginia Woolf is a play about marriage and the stories that married couples tell each other to make sense of their lives. When it opened in 1963, audiences were shocked by its raw language and its fiery confrontations between the world-weary associate professor George and his alcoholic wife Martha, both worn down by disillusionment and unfulfilled hopes, and yet clinging to each other for survival. Here's a moment from the movie version of Virginia Woolf, which starred Richard Burton and his wife Elizabeth Taylor, and which won for Taylor an Oscar for Best Actress. George and Martha are engaging in an all-night session of boozing and brawling in front of a young couple who've just arrived at the college and who become unwitting accomplices to the perpetual state of war in which George and Martha are engaged.
So anyway, I married the SOB. I had it all planned out. First, he'd take over the history department. Then when Daddy retired, he'd take over the whole college, you know? That was the way it was supposed to be. All very simple. And Daddy thought it was a good idea, too, for a while, until he started watching for a couple of years. Getting angrier? Until he watched for a couple of years and started thinking that maybe it wasn't such a good idea after all, that maybe Georgie boy didn't have the stuff, that maybe he didn't have it in him.
Stop it, Martha.
Like hell I will. You see, George didn't have much push. He wasn't particularly aggressive. In fact, he was sort of a flop, a great big, fat, flop!
Stop it, Martha.
I hope that was an empty bottle, George. You can't afford to waste good liquor. Not on your salary, not on an associate professor's salary.
Well, I think that play is shattering for a number of reasons.
Lindsay Ferrantino is one of the rising stars of playwriting today.
It's a steep, you know, examination of these two couples and a young couple, an old couple, and what does it mean to have lived a whole life together and how your relationship changes over time. But I think when I think of Albee and when I read that play, there's some detail about how the character is eating ice cubes and she's chewing on ice cubes and this just drives her husband mad. He knew the character so well to know not just what their bad habits were, but how those bad habits affect the other characters. And it's just such a great, you can hear just with the language of, you know, ice on teeth and glass, it just makes you uncomfortable to just hear those words. And I think that small detail is what has stuck with me.
Ferrantino's work is being produced in major theaters across the United States. And she's been commissioned to write new plays for a number of theaters, including the prestigious National Theatre of London. Her new play, Ugly Lies the Bone, has won multiple awards and is now playing at the Alliance Theatre in Atlanta. Ferrantino was mesmerized by Albee as a high school student, just as I was. And when she started her theater studies at NYU, she wrote Albee a letter asking if he would meet with her. She was making a documentary about the American poet W.H. Auden, and she knew that Albee had spent time with Auden and had been influenced by his work. To her great delight, Albee welcomed her into his home. It was the beginning of an important professional relationship, as she discussed during a conversation this week for Two Way Street.
It was my first interview I'd ever done in my entire life, and showed up at Edward Albee's house with the film crew, and my questions written on note cards, and sat in his living room and got to talk to him for several hours about Auden and about theater and a little bit about his career. And I remember regretting during the interview that I'd agreed to talk about Auden because I really just wanted to, you know, talk about him and his plays and his own work. And then he invited me to be a Edward Albee Playwriting Fellow. I applied with a play that I'd written after I met him. And so then I graduated from NYU and moved into his barn in Montauk, which he holds as an artist residency. You're sort of writing and your schedule is completely open and Edward Albee sort of stops by and brings you the mail and talks to you about what you're working on.
When you were in high school and you started reading him, what was the play that had the big impact on you? Or was it the whole body of the work?
There was one play in particular called, it's a little one act, it's not done that often, called Counting the Ways. And it's published in with this other one act called Listening. It's Counting the Ways and Listening. And it's sort of an earlier one act. And I couldn't make sense of it. And I just loved it. And I couldn't tell you why or what it was even about. But it was sort of halfway between poetry and a play. And the form was really open to interpretation. The story was really open to interpretation. And it was a man and a woman in front of a fountain. And it was sort of full of symbolism. And I couldn't understand it. And I just knew that I loved it. Because most of, you know, what you read in high school is Tennessee Williams or Shakespeare. And I had never sort of read something that was just sort of shattered what you're thinking of as like playwriting form. And in Counting the Ways, there's a line from W.H. Auden's poem, "We must love one another or die." And the line right before that is, "Art makes nothing happen. We must love one another or die." And that line is sort of included in repetition in this play of Edward Albee's. And when we spoke, and that, I think that's why I sort of was attracted to it, because I recognized this Auden line and was so curious as to why he chose to include it, and knew about his sort of relationship with Auden in this afternoon that they had spent together talking about art. And does art make something happen, or is it completely useless? And Auden at that time had sort of said that he wrote a lot of anti-war poems during World War II and felt like none of the poems that he wrote actually ended up saving a single Jew from dying in the Holocaust, and had this sort of huge guilt about does art actually make something happen? Does it make direct political change or not? And so when I spoke with Edward Albee about it, I think he said that Auden had sort of gotten it wrong. It's not about whether or not it makes something happen, but it's just about creating a playing space where things can happen and discussions are raised and a deeper attempt at communication is possible rather than direct political change.
Throughout his career, Albee came back again and again to the question of the role of theater in society. He talked about that in an interview with the New York Times.
Do you think theater should be comfortable?
No.
I think theater should be there to make people uncomfortable.
Are there any taboos left in theater?
Yes, I don't think you should be allowed to bore an intelligent, responsive, sober audience.
Albee's first play, The Zoo Story, opened in the United States in 1960. It announced clearly his intention to challenge audiences and established him as a playwright of immense talent. Written in just 3 weeks, it's a two-character, one-act drama that tells the story of Jerry, a young man overwhelmed by the loneliness and isolation of life in New York City, who encounters Peter, a seemingly happy married man with children, on a park bench in Central Park. And like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Jerry forces Peter to become an unwitting accomplice in his self-destructive drama. The Zoo Story gave me my first close-up encounter with the work of Edward Albee. As a struggling young actor, I had the great good luck to be cast as Jerry in a Chicago production of the play. And that allowed me to feel the rushing energy, the fear and anger that lived in so many of Albee's characters. Luckily for you, there is no recorded version of our production of The Zoo Story. But here is one of Jerry's moments from another production of the play. He's telling Peter about the shabby Upper West Side rooming house in which he lives.
But the one I'm getting to, and all about the dog, is the landlady. Now, I don't like to use words that are too harsh in describing people, but this woman is a fat, ugly, mean, cheap, unwashed, misanthropic, drunken bag of garbage. You may have noticed that I seldom use profanity, so can't describe her as well as I might.
He acknowledged on any number of occasions that his reputation as being difficult was well earned. But he also seemed to be very nurturing of young playwrights like yourself.
I think he was direct, to the point, often curt and a little cantankerous and very opinionated on sort of all subjects. And I remember thinking how he sort of stated his opinion as fact. You know what I mean? And was just he just believed so wholeheartedly in what he believed. But I think his actions were that of someone who was warm and nurturing, even if he wasn't in his sort of verbiage. Does that make any sense? Is that his actions, like I said, of responding to my letter, inviting me to the barn, checking in to see if I was still writing, that is the act of a generous person, even though he doesn't necessarily have the reputation for that.
So let's talk about parallels that I think I see between things about your work and life and Albee.
Yeah.
You grew up on the Space Coast.
Yes.
When you were a little girl, you watched launches regularly, right?
Yeah, our house was so close to NASA that it would shake when the shuttles would go off, yeah.
But you also were there when NASA discontinued the space program.
Yeah.
And you've said, I think, in at least one interview, and probably more, that you really recognized what happens when the American dream comes to a halt.
Yeah.
And Albee understood that, and he wrote about that as well. Does the dying of the American dream play much of a role in the work that you do?
I think it's everything. I think it's seeded into anything I'm thinking about or writing about or talking about. To grow up in a culture that is constantly encouraging you to sort of reach for the stars and everything is limitless and you can achieve anything. And then the reality of what that actually means. And especially in the time that I grew up in, which was going away to college I was in college in 2008 with the financial collapse and kind of kept coming home to my town, which was drastically changing physically and spiritually and economically as the space shuttle program was closing down. So I sort of just saw that and I felt like the space program was the embodiment of the failure of that, of if we're not looking up to the sky collectively as a country, what are we looking at?
It strikes me, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that Ugly Lies the Bone has an element of that in the sense that you write about a returning veteran, a woman who was badly wounded in the war, and comes home and has to struggle to find her place. And it strikes me that whole issue of veterans coming home and not knowing exactly where they stand
it
certainly is an aspect of the vanishing of the American dream, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. I had a friend who was becoming a psychologist at a VA center in the area, and we sort of just kept talking about this parallel we were seeing between the town sort of looking for a way to start over and the returning soldiers looking for a way to do that in a town that had no opportunity to offer them. And what does it mean to ask a soldier to go away and protect their hometown and then come home to a town that has changed as much as they have? And then I think in a larger sense, the play is sort of looking at people trying to live their life in the present moment, but struggling to do so. And so hopefully it's encouraging, like Albee says, people to live their lives more usefully and to be looking at your life in the present moment and not what it used to be or could be.
What do you want to be remembered as?
A useful playwright. I think that art merely being decorative is insufficient. It's to hold a mirror up to ourselves and to point out when we're being useful and when we're not, when we're living fully and when we're not. I can think of nothing worse than getting to the end of your life and figuring out that you hadn't participated in it, that you hadn't really lived it. And I think people should live dangerously. I think they should live at the precipice all the time and fully. Somebody said, I think it was in one of my plays, when is the happiest time? Now, always. Yeah, now, always.
I sort of don't want to say anything after that. It's sort of perfect. I think he was always talking about usefulness. How do you live your life usefully? And how can art show us our lives and how we're not living them usefully in order to encourage us to do so? And I think he did that. I think he did that in all of his plays and in his very specific own way helped other artists to do that so that there's just more art being made and more people examining our lives. Yes, including me. And I think he did that. And I think of that first interview that I had with him where we were talking about, does art make something happen? And I do see his encouragement of my life and giving me my first professional credit of being at the Albee Foundation as sort of the catalyst for which my life has happened.
Edward Albee's searing, sometimes opaque works challenged audiences for 5 decades. His body of work includes more than 30 plays. He won 3 Pulitzer Prizes, 2 Tony Awards, and more recognition than we can name here. I wanted to share with you one more example of his poetic, sometimes mystifying style. Here's Atlanta actor Brian Kurlander performing a powerful scene as George in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
When I was 16, I was going to prep school during the Punic Wars. A bunch of us would go to town the first day of vacation before we fanned out to our homes. And in the evening, we would go to a gin mill owned by a gangster father of one of us. And we would drink with the grown-ups and listen to the jazz. And one time, in the bunch of us, there was this boy who was 15. He'd killed his mother with a shotgun some years before, completely accidentally, without even an unconscious motivation, I have no doubt at all. And this one time, this boy went with us, and we ordered our drinks, and when it came his turn, he said, "I'll have Bergen. Give me some Bergen, please, Bergen, and water." And we all laughed. He was blonde, he had the face of a cherub, and we all laughed. And his cheeks went red, and the color rose in his neck. The waiter told the people at the next table that the boy had said, and they laughed, and then more people were told, and the laughter grew and grew. No one was laughing more than us, and none of us more than the boy who had shot his mother. And soon, everyone in the gin mill knew what the laughter was about, and everyone started ordering Bergen and laughing when they ordered it, and soon, of course, the laughter became less general, but it did not subside entirely for a very long time. And always at this table or that, someone would order Bergen, and the whole new area of laughter would arise. Yes, we drank for free that night. We were brought champagne by the management and the gangster father of one of us. And of course, we suffered the next day, each of us alone on his train away from the city. And each of us with a grown-up's hangover. But it was the grandest day of my youth. The next summer, on a country road with his learner's permit and his father sitting to his right, he swerved to avoid a porcupine and drove straight into a large tree. He was not killed, of course. In the hospital, when he was conscious and out of danger, when they told him his father was dead, he began to laugh, as I have been told. And his laughter grew, and it would not stop. And it was not until after they had jammed a needle in his arm, not until his consciousness had slipped away from him, that his laughter subsided, stopped. When he recovered from his injuries enough so he could be moved without danger, should he struggle, he was put into an asylum. That was 30 years ago. I am told that for these 30 years, he has not uttered one sound.
That's Atlanta actor Brian Kurlander in a scene from Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. The last new work of Edward Albee's that I saw was The Goat, or Who is Sylvia? It played on Broadway in 2002. It was the story of a successful architect married with a family who falls in love literally with a goat. It was as bold, shocking, and thought-provoking as anything Albee had ever written. And despite the outrageous theme of the play, it worked as a meditation on the strange and unpredictable nature of love. Theater lovers often say that the theater can change lives. Edward Albee was one of the playwrights who changed mine over and over again. And while I'm sad that there will be no new plays coming from his incredible mind, he leaves a body of work that will continue to change lives for many years to come. Before we leave you today, I wanted to give you a heads up about two upcoming shows we're recording in front of live audiences. You're invited to both. On Tuesday, October 4th, I'll be at the Carter Presidential Library to talk with author Kay Minshew about her new book, President in Our Midst, which documents the years that Franklin Delano Roosevelt spent here in Georgia and how our state influenced his political viewpoint. We'll start at 7 p.m. There's no admission cost and no need to make a reservation. On Friday evening, October 14th, the celebrated chef Asha Gomez will join me for the launch of her first cookbook, My Two Souths. That show will be recorded right here at GPB. Because Asha and her friends are preparing a reception with samples of her cooking, the free tickets to this session are limited. So if you want to join us that night, go online right now at gpb.org/Asha. A-S-H-A, to secure your spot. That's it for this week's show. Our producer is the ever-inventive Trevor Young. Our senior producer is the always ebullient Jenny Ament. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for being with us today. I hope to see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.